in 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach. And this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 20. Grierson, this podcast now has as many episodes as Ty Sheridan, Haley Steinfeld, and the new Spider-Man, Tom Holland, have years on this earth.
It doesn't feel as long as that, though.
It doesn't. Actually, I have to say, they feel, in fact, younger than this podcast. Have you seen that Spider-Man kid? That guy. I would make fun of him for not being able to grow a beard. But I can't grow a beard either, and I'm literally twice his age. Anyway, this is the Grierson Leach Podcast. Please, of course, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on Cloud, SoundCloud, and the New Republic. Email us at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. And, of course, please, when you go to us on iTunes, give us a nice review. And make sure, when you are doing so, to list the name of a movie. And we will review your movie in the reboot section. This week, thank you, Josh Feller. Your dreams have come true, Josh Feller.
Yay!
Josh Feller, guy who's bothered me. I'm overstating it a little bit, kind of, not really, about the number of reviews the times he has bugged us to review this week's movie, which is John Wick. John Wick is the movie we're talking about. Here is Josh Feller's review. He gave us 5 stars, so thanks, Josh Feller. The least you could do for bugging me about John Wick for about a month. He titles the review "The Best in the Biz." I live in NYC. Seeing a movie for me is a $200 commitment between a sitter, ticket, etc. As such, I literally base all of go or no go decisions on Grierson and Leach reviews. The podcast itself has improved dramatically. Again, we nailed it from the get-go. I know what you're talking about, Josh Feller. And is now at the point where I consider it a must-listen in a world with too many options. Well, in a world of too many options, we provide you clarity, Josh Feller, and we reward you for all of you bothering us. By bothering, I mean, of course, showing legitimate affection for the podcast. We are going to review John Wick. Now, the bad news, of course, is I mentioned on Twitter that if you bug us a lot, it will work. I've been on this podcast. Clearly it works because Josh bothered us a lot to do John Wick. Well, Matt Singer has gotten a hold of this and now yes. Mentions goddamn Gymkhana, which is the movie that he wanted us to do every week. So I'm sure we'll get to Gymkhana at some point. But this week it is going to be John Wick. I have to say, though, I usually watch Gymkhana every day anyway, so it'll be no problem. Whenever we're ready to do it, Grierson, I'll just snap my fingers and we'll go.
Yeah, this, by the way, is a window into your parental style, I feel like. If you just pester me enough, I'll just give in and do it. So
I'll give you your goddamn popsicle. Just stop screaming.
I have to say very briefly, going to a movie in Los Angeles recently and actually paying money and discovering it's now $17 for movies in Los Angeles, I do feel for this man having to pay $200 for all of that. It's expensive. It's very, very expensive to go to movies now.
So we're going to kick off our review this week with O.J. Made in America.
For us, O.J. was colorless. None of the people that we associated with looked at him as a black man.
A civil rights leader in Los Angeles has said if you are going to be a Negro in a big city, then Los Angeles is the best place to be.
All right, so O.J. Made in America is a 7.5-hour documentary made through ESPN's 30 for 30 unit. The director of the film is Ezra Edelman. This was originally thought of as a special event movie about a three-night event about O.J., and then he kept getting into it and adding more stuff on, and finally they just said, screw it, just go as long as you need to go. So it's worth noting that, of course, I think a lot of people think of this as a television event, and it is, of course, it is. It starts on June 11th on ABC, and will run the next 4 episodes will run throughout that week on ESPN, but it is, in fact, counts as a 2016 movie because it played in New York and Los Angeles for 1 week. I believe had an intermission halfway through. From what I understand, that's what they did. So anyway, this counts as a movie because I think the reason they released it in movie theaters is because they want it to be up for a best documentary Oscar, maybe potentially a best picture Oscar, depending on how ambitious they are. So it counts as a movie. So if you're like, hey, Chris and Lise, they talk about movies. Why are they talking about this TV show? Check yourself before thyself is wrecked. Grierson, I'm going to let you kick us off. You've seen O.J. Made in America. What'd you think?
Well, in terms of just quick background for people who don't know, really quickly, it is sort of a kind of creating a central thesis about O.J. Simpson. And what makes it different than the other ESPN movies and the 30 for 30 films is that it really is not about one particular game or one particular event. It really is the entirety of his life, starting in his childhood in Northern California, going through his time at USC, and then his professional career, then his acting career, though, of course, as one might imagine, most of the five-part film is devoted to the murders of Nicole Simpson and Rod Goldman, and then the trial of the century. And then the last of the five chapters is devoted to the sort of the after effects of that trial and what happened to Simpson afterwards. Every good thing, every, you know, bit of praise that has been sent this movie's way is absolutely accurate. What Edelman does is not just tell a life story. What he's really doing is essentially creating a thesis and then backing up that thesis. It is about the fact that O.J. Simpson, throughout most of his athletic career, the early years of his life, very much did not want to be perceived as being black, that he very much wanted to transcend race and have the color of his skin not be how people judged him. And especially during a time, and with Muhammad Ali dying so recently, this is even more prominent, though it's also mentioned in the movie, O.J. Simpson was popular at a time when the civil rights movement was going on and other prominent African-American athletes were talking about race and risking their livelihoods, their popularity, speaking out for that cause. O.J. Simpson did none of that. So in a sort of dramatic twist that really can only work in real life because in a movie it would seem ridiculous, he then is confronted of being very much the center of a huge racial conflict, not just in America, but very much in Los Angeles. I moved to Los Angeles in 1993, and one of the things that this movie gets absolutely correct is it paints the picture of what Los Angeles was like in the aftermath of the Rodney King riots, building up towards the O.J. Simpson trial. I had forgotten what it was like to live in Los Angeles and have most, though not all, African-Americans believe that he was innocent, and most, but not all, Caucasians thinking that he was guilty. And what a divide there was, not just in the country, but very much in the city where I lived at the time and still do. I think that what Edelman does essentially with his thesis is say, this was a person who wanted to escape his background, escape his heritage in a certain way, and simply because, I mean, I think we all know that he did, in fact, kill those two people. I'm just going to say that.
And I think the movie doesn't pretend that he didn't.
Yes, I think the movie is very clear about that. Because of those actions, O.J. Simpson was going to face some kind of incredibly dramatically rich reckoning. The documentary, I think, does a very good job of portraying that, doing it very smartly. In general, I have never listened to Serial. I watched 3/4 of Making of a Murderer. I kind of resist those types of nonfiction pieces because I really don't feel comfortable. And there's a great New Yorker piece about this after Making a Murderer came out, about this idea that those things are entertaining, because I don't find them necessarily entertaining. All I think about are the people that have been killed. And so I think the audience relationship with those types of nonfiction pieces can be very problematic. I think Edelman, to his credit, does a very good job of not making the trial and not making the incidents around the trial juicy in that way. So all of the praise that has been heaped on this movie, I think, is absolutely merited and warranted.
So I'm obviously very fond of the movie, but one of the things that I think is particularly strong about it is when you look at how black people reacted to not just the trial, but really everything about it, and how white people reacted to it. Not only were they different, they were from two different universes.
Yes.
Two different universes altogether. And as much as there's so much great stuff in this movie, and so much, there's some footage in this movie that's absolutely breathtaking. But this really isn't about OJ. And it is, and you're not going to walk away being like, why did I watch 7.5 hours about OJ that wasn't really about OJ? All your OJ stuff is there. But what I find most impressive with this movie is it is really about that central idea of black people and white people saw this trial in such dramatically different ways, and they could not understand how the other side was seeing the other side. The fact that we even have to use that, I think, speaks to kind of how this trial kind of polarized so much. I think it makes a very methodical case that, in fact, his not guilty verdict was, in fact, a civil rights victory. And in the idea, explains why people would think that, why everyone was celebrating, why, of course, people would be like, well, you know what? Even if he's guilty, I'm sorry, but one guilty dude getting off after hundreds of innocent dudes being killed, it's not going to even the scales, but you know what? It's a goddamn start. It clarifies that and focuses that in a way that is a little startling, but never off-puttingly. One of the things I really love about the movie, it's really fair to everyone. And like there, I think everybody in this movie that is involved in it gets a fair accounting as much as they could. And I think to be able to do that, maybe it required 7.5 hours, but I do think there is a firm hand on this movie, which I think is almost a reaction to the way we've been talking about the O.J. Simpson case and everything that surrounded it for so long, that there's almost a sense of, okay, I'm just going to take a step back from this and spend 7.5 hours explaining to you what this was really all about. And I found it in that way overwhelming.
Because this movie, for obvious reasons, does not include interviews with O.J. Simpson, it is a movie that in some ways, I mean, listen, like I've written biographies of bands that are like this, so I understand the problem, which is when you don't have the central subject, you have to find people around that person to talk about that person. And I think, again, to Edelman's credit, what he does is, you're talking about needing the 7.5 hours. One of the reasons why you need that much time is that even the people in his life who talk about O.J. Simpson, who pop up episode after episode, they change as the movie goes on, because of where they felt, like how they felt about OJ at one point in his life and how they felt about him in different points. This is not necessarily a new thing for 30 for 30. You have things where talking heads, you find out one thing about them, and then later in the movie, you learn something new. Even the, like the Scientology documentary that Alex Gibney made about a year ago, that movie is partly about the idea of how could these people be so blinded and not realize that Scientology was this horrible organization. You watch in Made in America, you watch these people who have worked with O.J. Simpson for years, been friends with him for years, who kind of came very late to the game to realize, oh, I think he actually did kill them. And they could not believe it. They simply, that was not the person they knew. And I think that even on that level, the movie is really fascinating about, and we haven't even talked about this yet, the two jury members that they have in
yes,
this
yes.
are really, again, I keep using this word, remarkable. It is impossible to watch the two jury members who are both black, because most of the jury was, and that's another great thing that the movie gets into. But the two jury members who talk about their experience of why they voted the way they did, it's impossible, and this is more to your point, Will, about almost being these two different worlds in terms of how they saw this trial, white and black. It's impossible as a white man to watch those two jury members and not think, what is going on? Not just the racial element, because I think also what's very striking is when one of the two jury members talks about the fact that she has no respect for a woman who's in an abusive relationship and doesn't get out.
That ex-boyfriend is very telling too.
Yeah, there's a great portrait in here folded in about spousal abuse and all of that kind of thing, which again makes the picture that this movie kind of paints bigger and richer and deeper. I mean, if you're going to call a movie Made in America, you're really sort of asking for it to a certain extent. You are really sort of saying,
yes. Here it comes.
Yeah,
we're
making something definitive. I wouldn't say this movie is necessarily definitive, but it gets awfully close to saying, wow, look at all of the elements that we as a country wrestle with, and they're all in the same story. It's a general rule of thumb that critics will praise movies that are over 2.5 hours long by saying, oh, it just flies by. It just flies by. No joke, this is a 7.5 hour movie that kind of flies by.
Yeah, and it's been fun to see the different things that people react to. Like, I've had some people that have reacted very strongly. There's a 15 say 15, 20 minute segment where Bill Hodgman, the former prosecutor, Bill Hodgman, almost out of nowhere, there's a 15 minute segment where it is explained exactly how OJ did it. Like physically how he did it, how he killed the two people, what happened. And it's put together in almost in a truly upsetting format. And it's funny because that's 15 minutes of a 7.5 hour movie that is, people reacted very strongly. People react strongly to kind of what my idea, the idea of the civil rights section. Because to me, one of the most fascinating things of it too is in the fifth section, which I think if we're going to talk about nitpicking wise, that might be the section I might want to talk about a little bit. And the fifth section is really about what happened to OJ after he was acquitted. And basically what happens to OJ is he learns very immediately that all the people that he spent his entire life trying to impress now want nothing to do with him. So OJ being OJ, he needs people call him the juice and be the center of attention and be the guy everybody loves. But the number of people left that are willing to do that are very, very small. And at first he tries to kind of awkwardly embrace his role as this civil rights icon, but he does it very poorly. He's clearly not comfortable with it. And inevitably, he kind of goes down this spiral a little bit to hanging out with just these comically stupid people that he ends up getting himself put in prison for. And I remember the great Seth Meyers joke about that when he was found guilty of breaking in and trying to get his memorabilia. So O.J. Simpson was found guilty of breaking and entering on Saturday, but really, murder.
Yeah.
And the movie, it doesn't lose steam because it's so well done, but that's the one part of the movie that I feel like you could lop off and make its own documentary of, because a lot of stuff, one of the things I talked with John Heilman about on the Culture Caucus podcast about this, that he brought up a great point. He's like, there's like 15 or 16 little moments in this movie where you're like, oh, that could be its own 30 for 30. But the point is like, I feel like that section, as strong as it is, it doesn't quite feel as much of a piece. It feels like the, and this is how it ended out. Whereas I feel like the first four and really first 85-90% of it is really all of the same piece. While that is, while completely compelling, feels almost extra and maybe not the big finishing kick that you're looking for a little bit.
It's interesting because I, as a Barry Lyndon, Magnificent Ambersons, Citizen Kane fan, there's like a part of me that really likes that last episode specifically because it is for two reasons. One, because there is this slow, terrible descent. And watching it, there's something I think about the importance of bearing witness to, he didn't get away. He didn't get away with it. And that in some ways, what ended up happening was its own punishment. It was not as obviously as severe as, you know, you're guilty of murder, you're going away for a long time. But there was another punishment that was waiting for him. And I think that that final chapter really gets into, if a viewer thinks, oh, that's right, he got away.
No, he didn't.
And then the other reason why I like the fifth thing, going back to the central thesis idea, to me, what he does in part is develop an idea of blackness that is so disgusting and regressive that I found it absolutely fascinating. Because I thought, wait a second, is this what he thinks being black in America is? Because he tries so hard to be, I mean, I know in some ways it's not PC anymore, but he tries to be a thug in a lot of ways. He tries to do this. And in watching, I thought, that's what he's been running from. That's the thing that he didn't want to be when he was a kid, or what he was afraid people saw him as. And once he is a pariah, in some ways, he kind of says, screw it, and embraces this much more kind of ugly idea of what being black is. And so for me, that's what's so important in that fifth chapter. For me, the things that I find a little limiting in the movie is, you know, I've spent a lot of time, and we've both spent a lot of time praising Edelman. I think that this is a movie, and this, there's no way I can say this without sounding like a total jerk, but here goes. This is a movie that, as well made as it is, I think is more of an incredibly collected, compiled, archived, put together piece. It is not a movie that I necessarily feel like there is an overriding kind of, well, I was going to say directorial vision. This is not a movie, I mean, comparing it to other documentaries, other documentary filmmakers, this is not an Errol Morris movie. This is not a Werner Herzog movie, though we both feel certain ways, similar ways about Herzog and what he does in terms of inserting himself. This is a movie that does feel, in some ways, done in a very smart, thorough, engrossing way, but doesn't have necessarily that kind of spark where it feels like you feel the hand of a vision guiding it. Now, I can understand that anybody who's a fan of this movie, and I'm also a fan, can find that to be a very snotty response. But I will say that over 7.5 hours, I'm glad that you added the context at the beginning of the fact that this was never initially thought of as a 30 for 30 documentary. This, to me, is a very, very, very underlined, very good 30 for 30 movie. But with that being said, it does have, if you've seen other movies in the series, this is the longest, this is the most ambitious, it's easily one of the most accomplished, but it does follow the formula a little bit. And there is a little bit loose in it.
I guess it follows a little, but like, you know, I've written about this before in my other life in the sports world about how, as much as I think the 30 for 30 documentaries are still good, like they're still pretty consistently good, there is definitely a sameness. There's no question there's a sameness. I don't actually feel that in this. I feel like it is. I feel like there are even stylistic risks that he takes in this that you would never see. And I think that it's, I don't know if this gets made without at least some of the backbone of a 30 for 30, but I feel like there are a lot of departures from that that I think separate it in more than just length and kind of scope.
There is definitely some ambitious and very impressive pieces. And I'll be very curious how much of that survives being on television, to be honest.
Yes.
I don't
yes.
know. I mean, I know it's going to be slightly edited. I don't know how edited it's going to be. And again, this is, I want to be very clear about this. These are very small nitpicks for me, but I think that for a movie that is this length, it is more intellectually enthralling and very moving in places. But to me, it misses that slight little thing, partly because I do feel that assembly line efficiency.
All right. Well, not surprised that we went much longer on this than we thought we would. It's a 7.5 hour movie. I feel like we didn't even come close to touching on anything, but we should probably wrap it up by giving our grades. I gave it a full blown A. It's my first, I think it's the first A we've had on the podcast. It's a straight up A for me.
It's a very high A minus for me. This movie is really, really tremendous. There's just a couple of things I nitpick about. So.
All right. Well, fair enough. Well, obviously everyone go see it. June 11th. Is the start date on ABC. But you're right. It's going to be an issue of what ABC and ESPN can show. OJ Made in America. Go see it, people.
Road to Charlie. Down to 47. Big is even good. You can't tell the heaven go that. Or run, 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 run. Take it too. Run, 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 run. Jigs to death in you. Tell you what to do.
All right, our next film, which we will talk about not quite as long because it is also not quite as long and delves into fewer American topics of the American conscious and culture and subconscious, is Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping. This comes from the Lonely Island guys, directed by Jorma, Akiva Schaffer and Jorma, I can never say it.
It's Taccone, right?
I don't know. That's why I can never say it. It stars Andy Samberg as...
Connor for real.
That's correct. As Connor for real. Basically, it is a mock documentary about Connor for real, a pop star who leaves his best pals in the Lonely Island, or the Style Boys, as they are known in the film, and to become a pop star.
Connor for real is actually saving the record industry.
Everybody's just waiting to see, like, what he does next.
Connor's hot.
You tell me you didn't see him and say, yo, he's the star. It's Connor.
Grierson, you like The Lonely Island. I like The Lonely Island. We both like The Lonely Island.
Yeah, I was going to say, should we alienate half of our listener base now by saying that neither of us are big MacGruber fans?
I think that's true. We're not big. I don't know why. I think... Let's not let's not legislate MacGruber, okay? Fine.
That's right.
People like MacGruber. But, yeah, have fun. Yeah, that's great. Yes. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm a big fan of the Lonely Island digital shorts on SNL. I'm a big fan of the albums as well. I listen to, this is not a joke, I listen to Incredibad maybe once a week or so. I think that in terms of, not since a movie that it gets compared to a lot, this is Spinal Tap, not really since Spinal Tap, I think has a like a parody group written so many legitimately good songs that also happen to be funny. And I think that they're, whether it's the videos that they do or the songs that they make, they just have an ability to kind of zero in on what is fun and silly and clever about popular culture. I think a movie like Popstar works because the people who make it really love all the stuff that they're making fun of. There's a real genuine, and I talked about this in my New Republic review, there's a real kind of giddy, playful spirit to this movie. There's not really a mean bone in its body. As close as it gets is making fun of TMZ, but nobody likes TMZ, so I feel like that's not even a thing that's even remotely controversial.
And it's not even that mean to them.
No, it's not. Though I will say, in comparison to the Inside Amy Schumer joke recently about it on her show, it's slightly meaner than that. But yes, this is not a movie that's trying to create a lot of wincing or, ooh, I can't believe they went there. Popstar is not a movie that ever goes there in terms of it. That being said, though, I did find it very superficially enjoyable. You know, we're comparing it to O.J. Made in America. This movie is 82 minutes long, I think, and it's just it's just the right length. It's done kind of like this is Spinal Tap, where it's somebody who was once popular, who is no longer popular, and all of his hangers-on, and it just sort of makes fun of the music industry, the Lonely Island, because they are successful and because they are popular. They have all their famous friends, from Questlove to 50 Cent to Pharrell Williams, all showing up and talking about Connor for Real and the Style Boys as if they're a real thing. And of course, they're all fans of these groups, or of the group rather. You know, this is not a movie that you remember, I think, more than, say, 5 minutes after you leave the theater. But as somebody who does find Andy Samberg in somewhat limited doses pretty charming, I thought he was Slow Death and That's My Boy, though, to be fair, that whole movie is Slow
right.
Death.
Yeah, blame him for that one. Yes. Go ahead. That's
he destroyed the That's My Boy franchise, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But when I watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I always enjoy him.
He's funny. And I want to talk about him very briefly, because I think he's not only very funny, but there is that puppy dog likability that you have. There's a sincerity to him. Like, there is, even when he's messing around, he looks like, you know, and I want to talk about this with the general Lonely Island thing, because one of the driving plot of the movie is, you know, this is telling the story of the Hardy Boy. What's the name of the band again? Lonely Boys?
The Style Boys.
The Style Boys. Thank you. The Style Boys. But this is really about the Lonely Island, you know, about them. You know, they made these videos on their own for years and years. And when they went up, this movie is like a mocking thing of their kind of going up. And the idea that, like, Andy Samberg is clearly the star of that group. They've all come together to still make these movies. I think one of the problems with the movie, and I do ultimately like it, it's actually not as funny as the Lonely Island usually is. And I'll put it this way. The funniest thing in this movie is the Fuck Bin Laden thing, which is, honestly, I've watched the video of the video that ultimately was on Saturday Night Live, and of course, which is not in the movie, but it is like that. That is like a great Lonely Island song that I love. Like, it's hilarious. It's a really good song. You hum it to yourself for a while afterward. It's very clever, but one of the problems is that doesn't actually make a lot of sense. A general issue with the movie, I don't know why Connor for Real would actually make that song. It's like way too clever of a song for him to make. And so one of the things that distanced me a little bit from the movie, as much as it has kind of these light laughs every once in a while, it really, it never really decides, is Connor for Real good? Should we like this music? The three songs that we get are all really Lonely Island songs. they're not really Style Boys or Connor for Real songs. And I feel like that's fine. Like, it's just a slight comedy and they're slapping jokes against the wall. But it does lead to kind of this slapdash feel of it, to where, you know, you see how they could have, like, pushed it a little bit farther than they did.
Yeah, I mean, I had actually heard because I had seen the SNL episode where they had that. So I knew that song going in. Equal Rights is actually the song. That's my jam off this movie.
Right.
I'm not gay, but if I was, I would want equal rights. I'm not gay, but if I were, I would marry who I like. It's not fair, I'm not gay, that the government has to say in who can love who not gay or to which god you can pray on a gay. It gets me so angry.
You know, I hear you about that character, the Connor character. The thing I do like about the movie, though, is I actually like that he's not actually evil. That he's actually not.
Right.
The worst you can say about the Connor character is he's kind of clueless and doesn't have sort of a really great grip on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, which is indicated by both the Bin Laden song and the Equal Rights song. But I actually kind of like the fact that he's basically an okay guy. He's just kind of full of himself. People, I know that some people who don't like this movie have said, well, in comparison to This is Spinal Tap, you know, this movie tries to be kind of, you know, sweet at the end. And my one thought to that is, number one, I actually think it works kind of nicely in this movie because the Lonely Island, those three actors have such a great rapport that it just makes sense. And then number two, my only bone of contention about This is Spinal Tap, which is, of course, a fabulous movie, and I've said this to people over the years and they've always thought I was nuts, I actually get so sad for those guys that it's hard for me to watch. We're talking about this with OJ Made in America. Like, Spinal Tap, like, the last half an hour is really painful for me to watch. Because when their lives are collapsing, I think, those guys are going to starve to death. They really have nothing else in their lives. And so the end of that movie, I always just, it's hard for me to laugh. And so I actually do feel like the sweetness at the end of Spinal Tap, you know, makes me happier. And in this movie especially, I think the way it kind of resolves itself, you know, because of the title, people will assume it's making fun of Justin Bieber, specifically because of Justin Bieber's documentary, which was called Never Say Never. And even on that level, like, it's impossible for me to imagine that any pop star would look at this movie and go, I think they're making fun of me. Like, it's sort of like anodyne enough that there's nothing that's really... And this was, to me, always the secret of the Lonely Island stuff, which was, these were guys who made Michael Bolton not the laughingstock of the song that he was in. Like, they basically kind of made him be like, okay, he's a big Pirates of the Caribbean fan, but like, you kind of like Michael Bolton in that. And whether it's T-Pain or Beck or Natalie Portman or whoever they have doing duets with them, their trick is to let that person look good normally, and they look kind of ridiculous. And I think in some ways,
I love the Kendrick Lamar. I'm actually thinking of the great Kendrick Lamar joke in the YOLO. Like his riff is great. Like when he keeps going about like being a smart investor.
4.2% 30-year mortgage. That's important. That's a great deal. And if you can't afford it, don't forge it on your last bill. Renting is for suckers right now. A dependable savings, and you'll retire with money in your account.
Part of the problem, I think, is of course when you are making short films and you expand to feature length. And this is where I think the MacGruber thing is worth pointing out. I think that these guys are just better in a short format. Feature length, there is a sense of that this feels padded and stretched in a way. And I definitely felt that way in MacGruber, where there were some really, really funny sequences, but there's a lot of this sort of stuff in between. And this movie, I think, also has a little bit of that, where you want some of these things to be from the movie, like their own viral videos, as opposed to a movie itself. But like I said, I laughed enough. I enjoyed myself enough during it that, I had to find enough time.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. It's not, listen, the MacGruber people,
we're going to have to review Jim Cotta very soon. Now you realize this, of course. Mr. Singer will be putting, you know, horse heads in our beds very soon, I think. Yes.
That damn vegetable in the butt thing is just like kills people enough that they just forgave everything else, I guess.
That sex scene in that movie is tremendous, I will say.
Yeah, that is funny.
That is really funny. And as a trigger warning to people, yes, Justin Timberlake is in this, but don't worry, he's in not in it too much. Yes.
Yeah, it's a groan, man.
Oh, it's a definitely. Yes, yes. As you well know, I was a big Timberlake supporter early on, but boy, I just think, God, I just get so sick of him. Also, for in terms of trigger warnings, yes, Jimmy Fallon is also in it, but not very much, thank goodness. Yes.
Yes, yes. But I ultimately could, I could not resist too far. I also, I'm going to go and give my grade. I gave it a fine, here's a B. It's a, right on that B, B minus notion, but I ultimately pushed up.
Yeah, that's where I put it too. It's like, yeah, you made me laugh. Good job, guys. Here's a B. For you.
Good for you. Yes. All right. So there is a pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping, which is a pretty awesome title. I don't think there's any question about that. All right. Now we go to our reboot section.
I lost everything. That dog was a final gift from my dying wife.
Jonathan, you got out once. You dip so much as a pinky back into this pond, you may find something reaching out to pull you back in.
Grierson, did we get a request on John? Yes, we got several requests on John Wick from the aforementioned guy. John Wick came out in 2014, is directed by Chris Stahelski and David Leitch, spelled the same way as my name, but as far as I know, we are not actually related. It's also produced by Eva Longoria, which I didn't know, which good for her. It is about a former assassin named John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, who we learn has just lost the love of his life, his wife or his longtime girlfriend, who I think is his wife.
It's his wife.
And she has died from some sort of disease. He is mourning her, and then from beyond, before she died, she left him a puppy. The puppy is killed, which is not a good thing to do for a retired former assassin. And then he just goes on a rampage and starts killing a bunch of people. And there's a lot of little turns in the movie, a lot of little nice little touches, but let's not overstep the plot. That's what the plot is. It's basically John Wick being badass in a lot of ways. Now, I've never talked to you about John Wick. John Wick was a movie that, you know, we were doing the Deadspin reviews when John Wick came out. And it was one of those, you know, when we put together movies, in fact, before we even did this podcast today, we had this long conversation of, hey, are we going to review this movie next week? Is it worthwhile to do? Is this a wide enough release? You know, we're not the New York Times yet. Well, we are not the New York Times. We do not review every single movie that comes across. Though back when we were doing the Yahoo site, we tried to get to everything. We always made a big effort to try to get to everything, which in retrospect is insane that we tried to get to everything. But
that's ultimately not what destroyed the site. But yes, ambitious and laudable of us to do
that. Definitely not what destroyed the site. that'll be a future podcast.
Yes.
But the point is that we don't get to everything. So John Wick was a movie that we felt at the time, oh, should we get to it? We have time. And I think that week it was a little busy. We never did get to review it. And then it became this huge cult hit. And now they're making a sequel. It's really kind of taken on a life of its own. But we've never actually discussed it. So Grierson, what did you think of John Wick? Give me some John Wick thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, and also at that time, and it's important to kind of remember this, a movie about a former hitman starring Keanu Reeves coming out through Lionsgate is not necessarily a automatic out of the gate must see movie. This was a first time film in terms of directing for these two guys who were stunt guys beforehand. So you didn't necessarily think, okay, this is a movie that people have to catch. I saw it. It opened in October of 2014. I saw it when it hit VOD, like a few months later. And by that point, a certain amount of critics had really kind of embraced it. It was never a big hit. It made like $40 million in the U.S. But it did, like you said, it became this cult sensation. I feel the same way about John Wick today, because I actually saw it again today, as I did when I saw it the first time, which is that action-wise, it's really, really good. And we talked about this a long time ago, you and I, about 28 Days Later. There have been lots of zombie movies. But what 28 Days Later did so well was it said, no, here's the thing. Our zombies are going to run really fast. And that's such a simple thing. And they were not the first people to come up with that, but they executed that idea so well that it made it feel like a new kind of like zombie movie. In John Wick, what they do so well, I was kind of caught up in this all over again the second time I saw it, was they said, no, as an assassin, he always shoots people in the head. And I love that that's never explained. Nobody says, oh, that's his thing. But you watch and go, that makes perfect sense, because if you're a good assassin, you shoot them in the head. Why don't other, like, badass assassins in the movies do that? And it it gets up to the level of almost being like a joke, but it's done so effectively that watching again, I was like, God, it's so such a simple idea, but it's so incredibly effective. And that you almost start to lean in expecting it as he goes along. And boy, does he do it a lot in this movie.
He does it a lot.
He does it a lot in this movie. I have never been one of those people who's thought, you know, Keanu Reeves is a bad actor.
Oh,
per
no,
se.
I think you've always kind of been a longtime Keanu Reeves supporter.
Yeah, and so when The Matrix took off that first movie, I thought, thank you, Mr. Reeves, for validating my belief in you. This is one of the better things that Keanu Reeves has done since then, obviously. On an action level, on a sleekness level, in terms of just, you know, for guys who, this is their first foray as directors, it's really well put together. It's really well edited. As a piece of craftsmanship, it's really great.
It's very confident. Yeah. It's very confident, really, from the very beginning. And one of the things I like about the movie, too, is it there's no the movie just is like, it takes its time a little bit for a movie that really gets revving up. The first 20 minutes, like, you wouldn't even know he was an assassin.
Yeah.
Like, for the first 20 minutes, he's just this sad person. And it builds its time, and it plays up with it. And to the point where you're like, wait, is this really guy just going to go crazy because his dog died? that's like a plot line that if you sold it, be like, this is ridiculous. What is this? Just like, the movie feels in structure, if you were to describe it, like a much more, and I'll talk about this in a second, much more of a fanboy wank thing than it's actually produced.
Yes.
In the way that, like, it is more well thought out than a movie like this necessarily had to be. And I find that consistently pleasing.
Yes, it is a movie that feels like it is based on a graphic novel, but it is in fact not based on a graphic novel. And the reason why the movie is good is because of the fact that there's no source material that wouldn't...
Dragging it down?
Yeah, or that wouldn't translate to film with, like, well, we gotta do this because... This is a big element of the book, of the graphic novel, but it has the world building and, more specifically, the kind of shorthand, the way characters talk to each other in the movie, where they know what they're talking about. We don't know yet, but we'll figure it out as we go along. That all said, I kind of wish this movie wasn't as cartoony as it is. It is... Is there more that you want to say? I want to...
Yeah, because, like, well, let's talk about what, like, I'll say that there's a couple times in this movie that are a little bit too clever or cute by half.
Yes.
Some of it's fine, and I appreciate it's part of the world building, but other, like, at a certain level, I find him more compelling than a lot of the stuff that surrounds him.
I would absolutely agree with that. My big issue is that when the movie is not being a pretty awesome action movie, the world building, to me, crosses the line too much into, isn't it cute how their world of assassins works? There's a kind of a cutesy, I said cartoony, but it's like a cutesy shorthand in terms of the way people are so blasé in terms of how they react around each other, that to me actually works against the movie. I don't find it to be a sense of an intimacy, of a knowledge of this world that they've made up. It feels like that's not believable in this world. Basically, people kill other people, and then other assassins see it, and they're like completely blasé about it. They sort of act like it's no big deal, and the way that they talk to each other is like this kind of drab small talk that's supposed to be like, oh, see, they're so used to this. And I actually think it works against the movie in the same way that a lot of the, well, John Wick, you've left this world, but now you've come back. And when you come back, it's impossible to get out of it. I am going to go on record saying I don't ever need to hear that dialogue ever again in any motion picture I ever, because if it's done well, it's done well. I don't think it's entirely done well in this movie. There is a certain element of, no, listen, he's a badass former assassin. He loved his wife, and that's why he left the world. She died. She left him this puppy. These assholes killed the puppy. It represents the only thing he has left of his wife. He understandably wants revenge. That's kind of all I need. That really is all I need. Now just go forth and kill. That's really all I need. And so some of the other things that are kind of woven in, it leaves me feeling fanboyish and going, can't he just shoot more people in the head? I would prefer that. Yeah.
I also think the villain is kind of lame.
He is, yes. And he's an actor I like, by the way. And he's it's Michael Nyqvist, and he's just sort of, I think.
Yeah, to the point that you almost like Dean Winters is into just like give his scenes a little bit more life, I guess. What's the name of his character from 30 Rock? I forgot the name of his character. You know, beeper guy, the beeper king.
Yeah, I can only think of him as the insurance person. He's Mayhem. Yes. That's how I think
Mayhem,
of him.
Yes.
Now, yeah.
I think of I will always think of him as the beeper king dummy on 30 Rock. But
Rat King.
Yes. So like those show up you're right, the villain's kind of lame. The finale is actually kind of lame. Like this weird car wreck scene. Like for as exciting as much as like the hand to hand and gun to brain battle scenes are. I feel like the ending is not that exciting. It's not really that much fun. I also think that Marilyn Manson song that keeps playing throughout the movie is not nearly as compelling as the director seemed to think that
it's so funny. I was actually gonna say that. Like, wow, see, Marilyn Manson will work on occasion. I think that song and wrote it down, but it's the one that plays in the middle and over the end credits as well, I also think is kind of effective.
Well, another thing I will say that I do like about John Wick is it has a lot, like, down to, like, the smallest supporting characters, it has, like, a lot better actors than it needs. Ian McShane has like 1.5 scenes. John Leguizamo has 1 scene. What's his face from The Wire has 1 scene.
What is it? It's Lance. Lance Roddick.
Roddick.
They use Lance very nicely.
The thing. Like, there's just like there's a lot of just like really good actors in like 1 small scene.
Yes.
And I'm like, I respect that. I respect that, like, down to the smallest detail for a movie that, again, they could not have, this turned out to be, I mean, I doubt they imagined this was going to get a sequel.
Yeah.
When they put this thing together. But, I think, and one last thing, I want to kind of close on this. Keanu Reeves is awesome in this movie. Like, he is absolutely perfect from every single, the only scene I don't think is, he completely nails it, is the scene where Michael Nyqvist has him tied to the chair.
I was just going to say the same thing. That's the one scene I think doesn't work in the movie. From his perspective, it's kind of like,
we don't need a speech from you, man.
Yeah, there is something about, I mean, I like Keanu Reeves. He is a limited actor. And by that, I mean, he needs to be on a somewhat mellow wavelength. He has to be kind of restrained, and that's why he works so well. When he has to get really amped up, it's not as effective. My last thing I have to say, though, I love the fact that Bridget Monaghan, who plays his wife who dies, mm-hmm. is in the sequel. So I'm hoping that maybe she sent him a second puppy, or maybe like a cat this time, maybe, or something.
Yeah. But she's like, open up the microwave, and she opens up, and there's just like a fish tank, little cute little fish tank. That's not on, like the fish are fine.
Right.
I'm just thinking something that would hold a fish tank like comfortably, but would also have a door that would have surprise. I'm thinking cinematically, Grierson.
Yeah, that's yes. You and David Leitch, I can see where the connection is now.
Well, as long as his name, I'm just glad his name isn't actually Will or William Leitch. Otherwise, every October, everyone would be yelling him about baseball as the poor Will Leitch. Will_Leitch is not that he's a reporter for the BBC in Northern Ireland. And every October, he's like, why is everybody yelling at me? So he got yelled at over this podcast. Just
I noticed that. I apologize to that Mr. Leitch. Yes.
Poor guy. All right. So that is John Wick. Go see John Wick. It's good. It's fun. It's also not available through rent or through a lot of streaming. Where did you watch it?
I actually used my Netflix DVD subscription to get. Again, why I hold on to that, I have to say, because physical DVDs are still nice to have on occasion, like this one.
So, all right. So that's John Wick. So thank you. So there you go. There you go, dude. We did John Wick.
And thank you for the nice review. And we are getting better.
I guess we must have been horrible at the beginning, because I don't think we're that great now. So, we must have been so.
You know,
bad.
People can hear this part too, right?
No. Anyway, all right, Grierson. So next week we only next week is a lighter week in the film in the movie release schedule, which is to say there are 3 big movies being released: The Conjuring 2, Now You See Me 2, and Warcraft. Which it's good to know that So basically, we have 2 sequels to movies that were not that beloved. Though The Conjuring got pretty good reviews.
Yeah, we both liked the first Conjuring. Yeah,
yeah, and uh, uh, and Now you see me, which, you know, vanished from our brains like a magic trick within minutes of seeing it. And then Warcraft, which is based on a video game. So let's not get too excited about the next week. So we're probably going to talk about one of those movies, probably Warcraft, just because it's Duncan Jones, who made Moon. But we have two reboot movies next week. The two reboot movies are, number one is Menace to Society, which is the Hughes Brothers movie from 1992-3. We'll also be talking about Being John Malkovich, which came out in 1999. Stars, of course, John Cusack, John Malkovich, 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 Cameron Diaz, Catherine Keener, and very briefly, Charlie Sheen, which is something to remember about Being John Malkovich, of course, directed by Spike Jonze and written by Charlie Kaufman. So, and produced by Michael Stipe, by the way.
That's right. Back when he was doing his brief film producing career.
It worked out pretty well for him. So we'll be talking about both of those movies in our reboot section next week, and we'll probably be talking about Warcraft. All right, Kirsten, we nailed this one. We'll be back next week with all those other movies. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week there, Kirsten.
You too. I'll talk to you soon, man.
All right. Peace out. Bye, everybody.
Bye.